From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the second of two discussions about military history. To what extent do social movements, ideologies, and intellectual currents affect the writing of military history? In their chronicles, how do military historians assess the interplay between technology and human characteristics, such as courage, honor, and duty? Should military historians offer theories or lessons that address contemporary international issues? The panelists are three military historians, Sam Williamson, Douglas Porch, and James Lutze. Sam Williamson and James Lutze teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where Professor Williamson serves as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and Professor Lutze directs the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense. Douglas Porch holds the Mark Clark Professorship in Military History at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. Sam Williamson and Douglas Porch recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where each worked on books about modern military history. Here is James Lutze.
Well, Sam has referred to the way in which the change to an industrialized society changed the entire nature of warfare. It changed the involvement of civilians in the war. In war, it brought to prominence the importance of economic factors and the industrial capacity of a country to wage a war. It broadened the subject, and I think that if we look at various social currents, you can see where the military and wars play very, very large and very intimate roles in that, not just necessarily in the furthering of a particular ideological development, such as the Russian Revolution or something of this nature, although, I mean, being a military historian, I can trace almost all great movements back to wars, if you will, that revolutions grow out of wars, that the American Revolution grows out of the great colonial wars, and that the Russian Revolution grows out of the First World War, and so on, and so that you can end the anti-colonial struggles and so on, get great impetus from the Second World War. But you also can look at social movements growing out of wars. I would argue, for instance, that the civil rights movement, if it does not start with, it gets tremendous impetus during the Second World War in the United States and in the position of blacks in American society, so that you can't study military history, as I think military history should be studied, without stumbling across these social movements and other movements, political and social movements, and then making and seeing the connections between the way in which they have been, you know, they've been furthered, in a sense.
Yes, someone, I don't know whether it was Sam or Jim, said earlier that the traditional view of war has been that it has been an interruption in normal human progress. I mean, what we would argue is on the contrary. It's a factor that it can speed it up or perhaps retard it, but it has enormous consequences. Not just war, but military organizations themselves. For instance, social historians have virtually ignored conscription as a process of national socialization, if you will, mm-hmm. or the spread of nationalism within various classes. This is one of the favorite methods used by governments in the 19th century to unify their states, to give people a sense of national ideology, so that armies became literally the schools of the nation, along with improved communications, along with an education system. This is what the French had to do after 1870. So in this respect, armies have a role which is not strictly military.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, for instance, to the criticism, though, Doug, that societies have been the victims of warmongers and leaders who are hawkish and tyrannical?
Well, this may well happen. It can't, remember, the army is an institution. It becomes a pressure group. It looks after its own interests. Now, obviously, it is in the interest of society to be able to contain pressure coming from any direction, whether it's military men or conservative groups in government or any group that pressures for war. As Sam Williamson said earlier, people it is up to the policymakers to assess war, and not only whether it's a viable proposition, but how it will be carried out. Now, What I would generally say is that the general conclusion of historians is that soldiers are usually certainly not the first people who want war, and often the last people who want war, because they are the ones who are aware of the consequences. And in a way, also, as professionals, I mean, it's a bit of a standing joke that soldiers don't like war because it spoils armies. But as professional institutions, this is often the case, not simply because they can't march around and put on pretty uniforms as before, but because they have to open their doors, especially if it's a long war, to recruits they wouldn't normally take in peacetime. They see it debasing the organization in terms of the personnel. It might also bring the whole concept of nationalism, as we've been talking about earlier, the place of the army in society. With the Vietnam War, for instance, the role of the American Army in society is very much questioned, so much so that we've abandoned conscription. Now, most soldiers I know think the Vietnam War was not a disaster for the Army.
Society is often looking for a scapegoat for why things happen. Obviously, I mean, a direct answer is obviously the society is often a victim of war. That is, they die in it, they spend their treasure, their lives are disrupted, and so on. But we look for simple solutions to that, why that happened. And often we turn to the generals, as Doug is saying. The generals wanted the war. They brought on the war that victimized the populace in this situation. And if that's not sufficient, we will look at the merchants of death theory that came out of the First World War, that it was the munitions makers and the Wall Street bankers that wanted the war. And it has long been a contention of Marxism and of socialist movements that it is the capitalists that bring on wars, and that wars are in the interest of the capitalists, and so on. I tend to think of any of those explanations as being far too simplistic. Now, sometimes they will apply. Sometimes it may be, and certainly in history it has been, that a single individual or small group of individuals or whatever have manipulated and have maneuvered and so on. But I don't think that very often that has been the way in which it happens in democratic societies or in more open societies, that's the way that it occurs. That's too simplistic an explanation for what brings about the war.
Sam?
George Marshall made a comment once, and after the Second World War, and here he had been Chief of Staff of the Army, he would later be Secretary of State and then Secretary of Defense, says, if you look at a political issue long enough as a military issue, it will become a military issue. And what you have to do is to make sure that you understand the difference between military values, or what Vats would call it, a great study called A Study of Militarism, written in the 30s, the difference between the militarism and the military way. And too often, in the current contemporary debates about American defense policy, the civilians are the biggest militarist of all, join in with some of their congressional allies, and more than occasionally from the White House. And this is in both parties. It's not a preserve of one party or the other.
I would broaden that aside from part of the intention of the curriculum that I work with is to suggest that the same that Sam says is true for policymakers is true for citizens in a democratic society. That is, most of these issues that regard peace and war and arms control and disarmament and so on are not so complex and technologically sophisticated that the civilian cannot understand them if they try to understand them. It was said, I think, by Lloyd George in the First World War, Sam can correct me, war is too important to be left to the generals. I would add to that war is too important to be left to the politicians, that the only true repository for decisions of peace and war and arms control and disarmament and other things is an informed populace. Now, I put an emphasis on informed, and I think it's important that they be informed, but that I think that often we think that military decisions are being made by people who got more knowledge and more sensitivity, and they may be more professional, but they can be understood, they can be penetrated by an informed populace.
There is a sense, I think, in which a lot of the current strategic debate, particularly about arms control and about parity and about who's got the first strike and so forth, has a great deal of similarity to what you would call the medieval debates about scholasticism. They have taken on a theological hue which says if you aren't inside the profession, you cannot understand them. And that's just simply just not true. It's self-serving. It's a little bit like a set of economic arguments made by economists. that would say that you have to understand all the nuances of input-output analysis to understand what makes an economy tick. When the simple truths are usually a good deal simpler and a good deal truer than the practitioners would like to have you believe. It seems to me that you have to understand institutions in order to change them. And it would appear to me that it is our failure to appreciate the sweeping nature. Now come back to the question you posed a minute ago. The sweeping nature of the impact of the military upon Western society and its growing role in terms of the political process, in terms of the budget process, that leads us sort of, in some cases, to be worse off now than we might have been had we paid careful attention and had society been studying this in sort of a continuous, in an attentive fashion.
No, there's extreme. I just wanted to say that there seems to be an extreme ignorance throughout modern history about military institutions. On the right, people have been militarized without actually being military. On the left, there has been a conscious cultivation of ignorance. And many left-wing parties simply have nobody who knows anything about armies. Occasionally, they would get a renegade officer who would come into a left-wing.
Except that they don't like them.
Mm. Oh, they don't. They don't
like standing armies. They're perfectly prepared to glorify guerrilla warfare and guerrilla movements, which they see as constituting social progress. Mm-hmm. And they may, in some cases, constitute social progress. A much more fundamental thing is how do you bring about social change
without war,
yeah. Without conflict? And in that sense, you got a far more complex problem dealing with a whole set of issues about modernization. And this takes us back to the question of the role of the military in society. Do they have a role in modernization? Mm-hmm. Can they be vehicles for modernization? Can they be obstructions to modernization?
You know, I think Americans have this terrible schizophrenia as far as war and the military is concerned. Americans like to think of themselves as a peaceful society, like to see themselves as slow to anger, as slow to get involved, as you suggest there. But actually, our tradition, our history is steeped in violence, whether it be violence against the original occupants of the country or if it be against some of our neighbors, such as the Canadians. I was reminded quite recently when I was speaking at the Canadian Military Academy that the fortress that had been built there had been built to keep the Americans out of Canada, and that and the Mexicans certainly would not view us as a Pacific people. And then even we have our most terrible war is this war against ourselves in the Civil War, which I think has a terrible formative influence on Americans' attitudes toward the regions and various other things. This was a terrible, terribly bloody conflict. The point being that we're a peaceful democratic society, the last to anger or whatever, but golly, we have sure beaten up on everybody in sight at one time or another, including ourselves. On the other hand, the military has played a very large role in the settlement of the country, in the development of the country, in socializing the country in lots of ways, from top to bottom. That is, from issues such as I suggested in civil rights, I can make out a pretty good argument that it was the experience of the military that helped popularize birth control in this country. That there are lots of ways in which people's connections with the military have reactions that you don't actually anticipate. So we have this schizophrenic view of the military and a schizophrenic view of ourselves. How does one explain that almost half of American presidents have had military experience? Not half of them have been professional military, but a large number of American presidents have used their military experience as a stepping stone or a promotional thing in order to get themselves into political office. We have this love-hate relationship in this country with the military that is similar to what could be referred to sometimes as the question of how a democratic society adjusts to the military, the marriage of Athens and Sparta in a democratic society. And Americans haven't really confronted, I think, in a realistic way, their relationship with the military.
Let me add just a footnote to what Jim said about the note that half the American presidents have been military. It's been, if one wanted to venture a major generalization, which would be subject to many modifications and caveats, it is those presidents with active military experience have on the whole best understood the military mm-hmm. machinery and been most skeptical of it, of whom Harry Truman mm-hmm. And Dwight Eisenhower would be the principal, along with John Kennedy, having mm-hmm. had enormous skepticism about what the military could do for you and the nature of the assurances, whereas those individuals who had far less experience, to include Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon.
And Woodrow Wilson.
And Woodrow Wilson, and even Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And the current incumbent, having had very little, if any, contact, are much more likely to buy hook, line, and sinker some of the blithe assurances that military individuals may give when called upon to give advice.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the second of two discussions about military history. The panelists are three military historians, Douglas Porch, James Lutze, and Sam Williamson. Douglas Porch is a professor at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. He's the author of books and articles about the military history of France in the 19th and 20th centuries. James Lutze and Sam Williamson teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where Professor Lutze directs the curriculum in peace, war, and defense, and Professor Williamson serves as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Douglas Porch and Sam Williamson recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where both worked on research projects about modern military history. Does technology win wars, or do hearts and minds win wars?
It depends on which army is fighting them, I think. The French have always stress the value of morale for the very simple reason that they're usually very short of weaponry. Americans, on the other hand, I think have, on the whole, tended to depend on weaponry to make up for often very unprofessional attitudes of the troops. There is a doctrine called hearts and minds, which, if I can define it generally, posits the seduction of the enemy, or at least a large part of the neutral population, rather than overwhelming them by force. Now, to do this, obviously you have to understand how the society works. Now, when you drop Americans who've been brought up in Kansas City or San Francisco in the middle of the Vietnamese jungle in a completely alien culture and a completely alien language, it's very unlikely that they will, in a short period of time they're there, really be able to understand not only the general cultural assumptions of that country, but also how the local hierarchies work. Who owes allegiance to whom? Who is the powerful man? What makes these people tick? So when you approach problems in this way, I think that you're inevitably doomed to failure. This was the experience of the French in Morocco and Indochina. In the end, they simply had to fall back on superior firepower to extricate themselves from all sorts of bizarre situations that they'd created.
I think there is no safe pat answer. I think one can find in a democratic society such as the America of the 19-teens, a president such as Woodrow Wilson, who gets himself involved in an ongoing war. Now, to be sure, he did not start it, but he certainly brought us into that war. You can look at the societies involved in the coming of the Second World War, and do you blame it on a weak, hapless, leaderless, for the most part, Britain and France failing to respond to the tyrannical behavior of this former German corporal, now Hitler, the tyrant. There are no safe sets of generalizations I think one can make. I mean, a democratic society may, in fact, as in the case of the splendid little war with the Spanish in 1898, we saw America go to war, then you may in fact see a democratic society go. The thing that strikes me as the most consistent generalization is that societies which are having internal difficulties and in which political power may or may not be, an economic power may or may not be fairly allocated, and those societies which have lost a sense of inner confidence are more likely to see in military solutions some sort of shortcut, some sort of cure. And it seems to me that if one seeks to explain the coming of the First World War, one has to look at that in the context of the Tsarist government of Russia, the Kaiser government in Germany, and Austria-Hungary. Societies not going to war to cure domestic ills, but having lost a sense of inner confidence, at least in the case of the Austrians and maybe the Russians, more willing and more inclined to go to war.
Sam, could you call that a theory of military history?
Well, there's one theory which argues that wars are caused by the need for elite groups to maintain their power position. That's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying is that when states begin to lose their self-confidence, when their political structures no longer respond maybe to the needs of the society, you get a sense of sort of fatalism and a sense of sort of impending collapse. And I don't think it's any accident that the Suez Crisis of 1956 reflected that attitude in Britain and in France. And one of the things that disturbs me as a historian looking at the longer pattern is will this be one of the long-term ripple effects of the Vietnam War? Countries are not destined to last forever. Societal changes do take place and readjustments do occur.
I think that another point that that I'd like to pick up on is that we talk about rational people going to war for rational ends. I think often we make a mistake if we think that people are necessarily going to react rationally when faced with a challenge. They sometimes will react irrationally, or they at least will not react the way in which you think that they will react. I think that wars often come about by a process of bluff and miscalculation. One side bluffs and the other side miscalculates, and or they both miscalculate and go through a series of bluffs. I think that what happens, and Sam might correct me on this, it seems that what happens in the First World War that the societies exhausted or felt that they had exhausted other means of solving their problems and turned to war as a simple solution to an otherwise intractable series of problems, and that they went to war because they didn't care enough not to go to war any longer.
Certainly that was the case in Vienna in the summer of 1914, thought that war was a less expensive, more practical solution than any other thing that they could consider, and they felt that they had tried diplomacy, economic coercion, political pressure, diplomatic encirclement against the government of Serbia, and that war, if long as the Germans kept the Russians out or at bay, would be something they could conduct that might in fact revive and restore the strength of the monarchy.
Well, I think this is one of the proofs of the viability of military history as a university subject. If for no other reason, it gets us away from the tyranny of economic explanations for absolutely everything, mm-hmm. especially in explanations for colonial wars, especially left-wing historians or commentators would say, oh, well, Portugal wants to hang on to its African colonies because they're of the economic benefits. But you can prove that it was an absolute write-off that was costing them vast amounts of money. The same for France with her colonial empire. She didn't hold on to these countries for economic reasons. They were psychological ones.
Well, Doug has hit upon, I think, one of the fundamental issues that historians looking at the start of wars fall back upon, is the importance of misperception, the importance of psychological dimensions, and these intangibles of which prestige and honor play enormous parts. And there is an anecdote which has to do with the possible British participation in a continental war before the First World War. And a senior French general asks a senior British general, says, how many troops can you send? And the British general says, well, how many do you need? And the French general responds back to him, said, send me a single private soldier, and I will ensure you that he is shot. By invoking the blood of this one British soldier, the French general knew that he would have entrapped the British honor into a continental commitment. And it is these kinds of questions of honor and commitment and prestige and defending one's allies and pride, those intangibles, much more than sort of nuts and bolts economic issues, much more than territorial issues, often sort of tilt the balance for the policymaker and lead them on the fatal choice.
Let me give you another excellent example of this. I once heard one of the chief planners of the Pearl Harbor operation talk at great length about how they had gone about, a Japanese planner, about how they had gone about planning the attack on Pearl Harbor and the arguments over using air power and various other tactical, strategic sorts of issues, where they were going to strike and so on. And it was all very interesting. And after it was over, I said, Colonel Genda, but that doesn't explain why Japan went to war. You told me how you went to war, but why did you decide to go to war? And he said, I often asked many of the senior officers that same question, and they often came back with the same answer, which was that all of their lives they had lived in the shadow of the British and the American military, and they had been looked down upon as a second or third or fourth rate power, that they had been looked at in a racist context, that they had been degraded, and that they realized that although the possibilities of success in the Second World War were not very great, they were the greatest opportunity they would ever have to regain their honor and their sense of prestige and their feeling of the greatness of Japan. And that if there was ever to be a time, it had to be now, in December, in the fall of 1941, otherwise the balance would tilt against them. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it gives a kind of a bizarre twist to the way in which wars begin, and it indicates how hard it might be to anticipate what the feelings of the other side are going to be. If you take a look at it and you add up your little columns and balances and say, well, they won't do this because of this, you have to factor into that. But what are the psychological dimensions of this? What do they see in the context of the time that might be there to their advantage? And it makes it very difficult to anticipate with any assurance what is going to make people go to war or desist from going to war.
Well, I hope we've been suitably vague. if we were social scientists, no doubt we would have various categories of different sorts of wars and how they start, and it would all seem very neat until another social scientist came along and broke these up. But I think this is the function of the historian, to stand back and take a detached look at things, intuitive rather than scientific.
I think to make a plea for historical study generally, as well as the study of military history and strategic history, it is that those people in decision-making positions and the environment in which they operate are a product of the historical forces of not just one or two days or one or two months, but of a long period of time before, that they bring certain images with them about the past, and that one has to have a fairly intimate understanding of the environment out of which the policymakers have come, if one wants to sort of begin to understand how they will react to these kinds of situations. And knowing that sort of environment is tremendously important, and then trying to gauge for the historian why decisions were made. And Jim has alluded to the question about Japanese feelings of inferiority. And I think those, if you looked at the character and relationship that the Japanese had with Great Britain and with the United States in the period after the 20th century began, what you found was a period of almost benevolent paternalism being expressed toward them. Oh, aren't you such nice little imitators, but you're nice and little, and you're going to be sort of our friendly comrades, and you're never going to do anything and never going to really grow up. That sort of paternalism is a kind of long-term psychological conditioning. And we see some of that, I suspect, today in relationships in Central America, in which you have attitudes formed over a long period of time, which now may bear no relationship to present reality, but which form a part of the mental baggage. So that the cliches are about the power of the United Fruit Company in Guatemala and so forth, where it hadn't been in a long time or in certain other areas, but the mental baggage that people are taking with them. So that the military historian faces a complex task, not only of understanding what the soldiers were wearing, if he cares to get into that antiquarian pursuit, but the whole environment in which the military institutions function.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the second of two discussions about military history. The panelists were three military historians, Sam Williamson and James Lutze of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Douglas Porch of the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about architecture and contemporary American social values. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for Patterns Called War, the second of two discussions about military history. To what extent do social movements, ideologies, and intellectual currents affect the writing of military history? In their chronicles, how do military historians assess the interplay between technology and human characteristics, such as honor, courage, and duty? Should military historians address contemporary international issues? The panelists are three military historians from the University of North Carolina and from the Citadel. The concluding segment of Patterns Called War, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.